Today on the 21st, can film in the arts be a vehicle to making conversations about mental health and disabilities easier? Also in film, the American icon Jackie Robinson.
Part of what I admire about Jackie Robinson is precisely his ability to approach baseball and those first 2 years of integration in ways that were contrary to his character or his fundamental sense of what was right and wrong in service of a larger cause.
Tonight, documentary filmmaker Ken Burns has turned his sights on the baseball legend. We bring you a preview. And we're also wishing a happy 100th birthday to one of America's most beloved authors.
Beverly Cleary's books turned our oldest son into a reader, and now I love sharing her writing with our grandkids.
That's all coming up on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. I hope you enjoyed your weekend. Film critic Roger Ebert always said he believed that movies, films, were vehicles for empathy, that they were ways to step into one another's shoes and really experience someone else's life. The 18th annual Ebert Fest starts this week in Champaign, and since 2008, Ebert Fest activities have included panel discussions about how the arts, and film in particular, can help challenge stigmas in society. After all, what better way than film to challenge stereotypes?
I hear voices. I didn't tell you that. I didn't want to scare you away.
The talking in your head, that's part of the song?
Jesus Christ! Stop!
Ryan, time for your pills. Come on.
You think that I'm crazier than you.
Because we're different, I mean.
Oh, you're killing me. You know what? Forget I offered to help you. Because that must have been crazy. Because I am so much crazier than you.
I don't have my maple syrup either. I'm gonna be without my maple syrup and my toothpicks.
You don't see any pancakes, do you, Ray?
Maple syrup is supposed to be on the table before the pancakes.
We haven't ordered yet, Ray.
Of course, when they bring the maple syrup after the pancakes, it'll definitely be too late.
We haven't ordered the pancakes yet. How is that gonna be?
We're gonna be here the entire morning with no maple syrup,
Ray.
and no toothpicks. I'm definitely not, Ray, gonna have my pancakes with ow!
Don't make a scene. Stop acting like a f***ing retard.
Scanlon, Cheswick, You're voluntary.
Mm-hmm.
Billy, for Christ's sakes, you must be committed, right?
No.
You guys do nothing but complain about how you can't stand it in this place here, and then you haven't got the guts just to walk out. I mean, what do you think you are, for Christ's sake, crazy or something? Well, you're not.
Well, that's a look at different montages through film, how mental health and disability have been challenging stereotypes. And this Thursday, a panel of experts will be talking about this at Ebert Fest. It's called Challenging Stigma Through Love, Mercy, and the Arts. Here in studio with us now to talk about the event is Lynn Canfield, who serves on the board of Champaign County's Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities, and she's the main organizer of the event. Lynn, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Also in studio with me is Joe Amaga Osagie. He's a counselor at Parkland College in Champaign and will be on the panel at this year's event. Joe, thanks for being with us as well.
Thank you.
Joe, you were first on this panel 5 years ago. Why did you decide to participate? Why is this issue so important to you?
This issue has always been important to me, and it really became much more important to me when my brother took his life over 5 years ago. And initially, it was a job, and now it's more than a job. It's a passion. It's something that I hope we all learn something from. Losing someone to suicide is, every day we lose someone to suicide, several families are left to wonder why.
And since you're one of those families, in addition, as you said, this is your job, but this is also something you've experienced personally, I wonder what you learn from that you would want to share with other people?
Listen. Listening is an act of love. I mean, use your whole body to listen and create a community of care so that we all can realize that there is something going on. There's something a little bit deeper when someone says, I'm really down, and not say, oh, just get over it. Because just get over it will not work, has not worked. Medication's a part of the answer, but I think the larger community understanding this individual person makes a difference.
So, Lynn, Joe was just talking about people saying get over it, and I wonder if you see that as part of the stigma of mental health, of just saying, particularly when people are going through depression or fighting thoughts or a notion of suicide, do you think that that's part of the stigma, is just that people think, well, just get over it?
Sure. Yeah. I think there's also the internal barriers are really important. So we could talk about discrimination, which is maybe me saying get over it, or that's so strange, stop. But internal feelings about a mental illness and what it feels like to be disorganized mentally and emotionally, I think are actually really important barriers that we also need to talk about. We can really talk about inclusion pretty effectively because we know when we're not being inclusive, mm-hmm. right? But sometimes to understand what it takes to be included is really different. We really have to listen in a different way to people who are marginalized because of a disability or a mental illness. And, you know, like the physical accessibility is a wonderful metaphor. Like, I wouldn't know that it's hard to get a wheelchair through a door unless I was in a wheelchair or with somebody who couldn't get the door open, right? So, I mean, I think because people have worked pretty carefully on physical accessibility, now we take that work and use it as a metaphor for what we need to do differently for people who have more invisible disabilities.
Mm-hmm. And how do you think the arts can help overcome those barriers? Is there a role you think film in particular can play in overcoming this?
Yeah, film seems to have at least a short-term impact on people's negative attitudes. It helps to increase empathy, at least for a while. Reading fiction apparently has maybe a little bit more lasting empathy. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, part of a montage was Rain Man.
Right.
And after Rain Man, we seem to take autism differently.
Right.
Prior to Rain Man, we'd never really talked about autism. But now, Rain Man was kind of the epicenter of autism.
Mm-hmm.
And we are in a, for lack of a better, a movement to change how we think about this. It is not just about getting over it. It's about understanding when someone has diabetes, it's a disease of the pancreas. Mental illness is a disease of the brain. And until we're able to start recognizing it in its entirety, we're a society of, hey, the rugged individual. Mm-hmm. But you know what? The rugged individual needs a community, needs to be heard, wants to be heard.
I think Rain Man is an excellent example of providing us with a shared, it provides us all with a shared experience of autism. And autism is, it manifests differently mm-hmm. in almost everyone who has it. So every person's experience of having autism is individual. And then every family's experience of understanding autism is different because it is by necessity just specific to the person that they love. So it was important, especially with autism, to have something common that we could talk about. Like, oh, look at all of the different areas of life that this particular condition can impact. And that was a really mm-hmm. compelling performance,
yes.
too. It wasn't a documentary, so mm-hmm. that gives us
and
sort
do you
of
think
a
that
safe,
makes a difference,
experience.
Right? If it's not a documentary, maybe perhaps
yes.
there's more of a entree point
yes.
for if it's maybe a movie as opposed to a film. I mean, we could have a whole
yes.
other discussion about that, but does that make a difference?
Absolutely. I think documentaries are wonderful, and I mm-hmm. personally watch a lot of them, but for broader reach and for a nice, simple, shared point of understanding, Rain Man is an excellent example.
So Rain Man did that for autism. Mm-hmm. And you all on this this Ebert Fest panel on Thursday mm-hmm. Are going to be discussing not just disabilities, but also mental health issues. And I wonder, mm-hmm. to get back to our previous or what we started this conversation with, which the notion of suicide, mm-hmm. is there a film? I feel like that is there something in particular you can point to that is that breakout?
Rain Man for suicide?
Mm-hmm.
Well, or just something that is maybe more a common entry point for that discussion.
Mm-hmm. There are
several. I'm working with teenagers over the teens and young adults over the last 20 plus years. Dead Poet Society was one that we used when we talked about the suicide of a young man in a school. I mean, it was a conversation we had in Operation Snowball about should we show this movie in its entirety so that we could actually discuss it. And it was a back and forth for several days as we planned our retreat. Mm. And that was, we eventually did show the movie and we had a good conversation about it. And I think what movies do, it demystifies some of these issues and gives us a chance to talk about it. There was an MTV, I did not see the MTV Awards yesterday, but the caption for the MTV Awards.
The movie awards last night.
Mm-hmm. The movies that people actually watch. And that's the entry point because these are popular movies.
That's important.
Yeah, people get to see these movies and you can relate to them in a way that says, okay, it's non-threatening.
And I feel like for you all, I'm curious your perspective on, you all have been participating in this panel for years. Do you feel like there has been an evolution in how we're discussing, particularly around, like we've talked about an evolution in autism, an evolution perhaps in people with physical disabilities. Is there an evolution in the way that we discuss mental health and in particular depression and suicide? Do you think that that's improved in society?
In society or in a panel discussion?
And well, I feel like the panel discussion hopefully would reflect what's going on in society, right? So do you
I
all...
think it would be very hard for either of us, I'm sorry, mm-hmm. to speak for you, Joe, but hard well, for any... us to comment on how it's changed in society because we could have a nuanced conversation like this till the cows come home, right?
Do you think it's gotten
better? We're in bubbles where this is what we talk about. Yeah. For the panel discussion, I can share with you that it has changed over the years, but I can't be sure what the variables are which changed it. We have participation from both filmmakers and critics, guests of the festival, and then local experts like Joe. Mm-hmm. And they have maybe figured out a way to talk to each other that's really entertaining in itself and brief. So
so that's interesting. Yeah. Do you think that's changed within the film community?
So. Yes, and I think maybe the panel discussion...
It's okay, everybody's got colds going around. It's all right, Joe, you can cough.
I think it's attracting festival guests who may have a connection to these issues, too. We hear people talking quite freely about their personal experiences around these things, and they're festival guests. They don't have to. We may be professionals in that world, but they're not.
Yeah, so I mean, nice. And I think what I've said also is, yes, the festival guests do talk about their own connection to mental illness, their own personal stories about mental illness. Yes, we're it's on a bigger scale. Yes, it's the conversation is a little bit more open, and we're having there has been movement. It's not solved the problem, but there has been movement in which we're trying much harder to have these conversations and to really stop thinking of it as a weakness of character. Mm-hmm. And as a mental illness.
And that's fundamentally, is that, Joe, where you see the stigma that we see this as a weakness of character?
Yes. That's my personal opinion. And also some of the literature will support that culturally we still see it that way. Anyway, I mean, and looking at the communities of color, I mean, mental illness is something that we don't want to talk about. Africans don't want to talk about it. Latinos don't want to talk about it. Asians don't want to talk about it. However, I mean, for lack of a better word, the average white community is still a little bit more open about it. But the rural white community probably isn't as open about it. There is this whole idea that thinking that if you do commit suicide or there is a selfishness about it that you have been selfish to take your life and your family's now left
and
to
when
deal
you're,
with it.
And Joe, when we're particularly talking about communities of color and we're thinking about, there's so many layers to that, right? Because there's immigrant communities, there's different cultures. You know, you mentioned so many different culture and ethnic groups just within what you said there. Do you think that film can help reach those communities as well? Do you think it's part of just how we're seeding this through popular culture, no matter where you come from?
I think so.
Well, last year's film was you know, we were able, it really does also depend on the film. And even mm-hmm. though we won't have seen the film until Saturday and the discussion is this Thursday morning, so they won't give you spoilers, but some of the issues we are able to introduce are particular to the film. So last year,
and which film is this that you're discussing?
This is Love and Mercy.
Love and Mercy.
So we'll probably hear a bit about the creative process and maybe the, you know, how that creates a risk for people who may be vulnerable to mental illness or substance use disorders, that the creative process itself can be kind of an mm-hmm. additional risk factor. Yeah. And then there's some themes around family support and legal problems. So it's a nice platform for those particular discussions. Last year, we were able to talk quite a bit about race, gender, and immigrants, the mm-hmm. particular experience of immigrants in a community that stigmatizes them. Mm-hmm. So, and a few years before that, we were able to address LGBTQA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. So it's
and
like
family rights.
Mm-hmm. So there's just so many mm-hmm. conversations where I imagine both of you feel like this conversation just needs to keep happening.
Yes. And filmmakers are interested in these themes and are always producing things that give us those opportunities. It's just how we create the opportunity and manage the discussion.
Mm-hmm. That's Lynn Canfield. She's on the Mental Health Developmental Disabilities Board for Champaign County, and she's part of the organizing panel of a panel that will be taking place at Ebert Fest on Thursday. I want to thank her as well as Joe Ama-Osagie, who's a counselor at Parkland College and will also be on this mental health panel this Thursday. Thank you for being with me.
Thank you.
Coming up, Ken Burns has turned his sights to American icon Jackie Robinson. We're going to continue with our film theme by speaking with one of the advisors to the documentary, which premieres on PBS stations tonight. You're listening to The 21st. Stay tuned.
The 21st is made possible by Custer & Bradley, LLP. Providing legal service to the Urbana-Champaign community since 1895, Custer & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at CusterLawLLP.com.
I am proud of my blackness. Proud of the accomplishments of black people. Think of me as the kind of Negro who comes to the conclusion that he isn't going to beg for anything, that he will be reasonable, but he damned well is tired of being patient. Jackie Robinson.
This is The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo, and that was the voice of Jamie Foxx reading the words of Jackie Robinson. It's from a two-part Ken Burns documentary on the baseball legend that premieres tonight on your local public television station. Describing Jackie Robinson as a baseball legend is probably a term Ken Burns and his team would avoid, because I think if you're going to take anything away from this four-hour work, it's that Robinson should be viewed for his place not just in baseball history, but in American history. For Robinson's pioneering work before the Civil Rights Movement began and that continued long after his baseball career had ended, this documentary really helps establish Robinson as an American icon for those who may not have known before. Adrian Burgos Jr. is a history professor at the University of Illinois, and he served as an advisor for the documentary and joins us in studio now. Hey, Adrian, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, and this is Jackie Robinson Day is coming up in a couple days. So all of the baseball teams will be wearing number 42. Do you think that we've put Jackie Robinson in a box of being a pioneering baseball athlete and maybe not realized his greater place in American history?
I think, yes, we do. And what the documentary really powerfully does is to allow us to see Jack, as Rachel Robinson calls him, and Rachel. And by allowing us to get to know them as a couple, as a group of African Americans who are pioneering for something greater, not just in baseball, but beyond, it really kind of pushes all of us Americans to think about what Jackie sought to do more than what he did on the field was to transform America and its race relations. And that is the story, I think, that Ken, Sarah, and Dave have done a masterful job in challenging a lot of the myth of the icon Jackie Robinson to the lived experience of pioneering that Rachel and her beloved Jack went through.
And when you say that team, you should explain to our audience, it's great to have you here with us. Dave McMahon, if I pronounce that correctly, he was actually one of your former students.
Dave McMahon was one of my students when I was a graduate student at the University of Michigan. He took class with me. And Dave has grown in his place within the Florentine Films team. And it's wonderful to see an undergraduate, just like some of my undergraduates here at the U of I, flourishing to doing amazing work beyond undergrad. And he brought me in to be part of the Florentine family of advisors. And when we were there last year to preview this film, as I was mentioning off air, they had us in tears in terms of just the power of this documentary. I really encourage everyone to spend some time with it.
Yeah, well, I was to say I was in tears a couple times this weekend watching it. And I think because I learned so much about Jackie Robinson, and I'm not a huge baseball fan and don't know that much about baseball history. So for me, I think even just, and I think this would be helpful, I wonder if you could talk about the time frame in which he started, because he was someone who participated in sit-ins, as they say, before people did sit-ins. He staged his own sit-in at a lunch counter at a Woolworth in California decades before this became a movement. And this was around the time he was at Pasadena Community College. And I wonder if you could place for everybody that time period. First of all, his ability to be at a community college as a Black man. And this was the 30s, right?
Yes, and this is one of the powerful parts of understanding Jackie Robinson. Integrating baseball was not his first effort and participation in this grand effort to transform America into an integrated society. And so there's a little bit of a discussion of when he was growing up in Pasadena and some of the struggles that we often don't think of Pasadena or California as a place where the color line shaped people's lives. And so by going to Pasadena, the documentary allows us to see how these struggles were not just a Southern phenomenon. It was a nationwide dynamic. And whether he was in Pasadena or Fort Hood resisting how the buses were being segregated or playing professional baseball and the Negro Leagues and experience of segregation moving through the South, what it's reiterated in the film is baseball was not Jackie's first best sport, actually not his second or third. It's like his fourth best.
And that's what I was going to ask you also, because there's a line in the film where one person describes Jackie Robinson as the greatest athlete in American history. Would you agree?
I would agree because...
Because he played, and remind for everybody, his brother was an Olympic track athlete.
Well, and I'll give you a little anecdote. So in 1936 Olympics, the Jesse film captures...
Mm-hmm.
He came in second to Jesse in one of the races. That is Mack Robinson.
Brother.
That's
right.
His brother. Well, Jackie broke every single one of Mack's records at UCLA.
His track records. So he broke his brother's Olympic, his Olympiad brother's records. He broke running track.
He
played football.
All-American in football. All Pac-8, as it was then called, in basketball. And then he played baseball. And actually, some people want to push that he probably was a better golfer than baseball player,
too.
Oh,
he played golf as well.
So, you know, when you consider the totality of his skills as an athlete, he was amazing. But then we consider, and I think rightly so, the totality of his experience beyond the playing field, we really see this compelling story about how integration involves so much more than what happens between the white lines.
And I think when you think about that, the integration, and again, I think for people who maybe have a superficial knowledge of Jackie Robinson, you know, okay, well, he was the first Black player. He played for the Brooklyn Dodgers. But as the film goes into the emotion, I can't even begin to imagine the emotional toil that it must have taken on him. There's one point someone describes him as the loneliest man in sports. He cannot stay in the same hotels as the rest of the team when he's traveling. He endures years of abuse, both emotional, verbal, physical, while he's playing on the field. I mean, how would you describe what he had to endure, especially those first couple of years?
The first few years, and I think that description of him as the loneliest man in America, really, between the white lines and even in the clubhouse in those spaces, not having the assurity that all my teammates have my back and will support me whatever I'm doing and going through made him extremely lonely. Knowing that while Branch Rickey, the general manager and team vice president, had your back, that not everybody else did as well, really made things challenging and that you had to persevere. And that's why the relationship between Rachel and Jackie Robinson is really a centerpiece of this documentary, because without Rachel, Jackie doesn't get through this.
And I think that's actually probably my favorite part of this documentary, is learning about Rachel, who's still alive, and their relationship. And it's such a beautiful love story. And do you think she gets enough credit for the role that she played in his life?
I think this documentary, by centering on Jack and Rachel, does place her, rightly so, as that person who pioneered baseball's integration with Jackie. That, again, if he's a single African-American man, he does not successfully persevere the way he did.
There's this great moment in the documentary that I want to play where the credit that's given to Rachel actually comes from Michelle Obama. So let's hear how she described their relationship.
There's nothing more important than family than a real partnership, which is probably what made him such a great man, because he had the judgment to find a partner that's true. I mean, I think that's a sign of his character, that he chose a woman that was his equal. I don't think you would have had Jackie Robinson without Rachel.
The great part about that, and this is the beauty of video that you cannot see on radio, is that First Lady Michelle Obama is saying that sitting next to her husband, President Barack Obama, and he has a look on his face when she says that, where he realizes, I have to agree with my wife. But I think it's an interesting thing. I wonder, as a historian, my guest in studio with me is Adrian Burgos Jr. He served as an advisor to the film Jackie Robinson, which is airing on PBS stations tonight. I wonder, as a historian, I know you're kind of a baseball historian, but I imagine, just as a general historian, how much you see parallels between Jackie and Rachel Robinson. And I think the inclusion of having President and First Lady Obama in this film sort of speaks volumes to where we are as a nation, but then also maybe a similar story being played out.
Well, I think the other part of this, we just saw a couple of weeks ago when President Obama became the first U.S. president to step foot on Cuban soil in nearly 90 years. Who does he have on Air Force One with him? Rachel and Sharon Robinson. President Obama is a big baseball fan.
Sure.
And for those of us who watch the game, you also notice that Michelle Obama is a big baseball fan. And there was a couple of times where she kind of chided President Obama from distracting her from what's
going
on. When
they were watching the game in Cuba.
Yes. And so this also speaks to the importance of sport as a means of cultural building and in the place of African Americans, but also between the U.S. and Cuba. And that President Obama was acutely aware of that and used that as a means of trying to extract a new relationship, a rebuilding of sorts with Cuba. This is exactly the kind of thinking that someone like Rachel and Jackie Robinson engaged in.
Well, it's a fascinating thing to think, if you move forward, of the legacy of Jackie Robinson using baseball to change American society. And what you're saying, President Obama now, I don't know how many years later, I guess 60 years later, using this as also a way to maybe change a political situation.
That's exactly what I'm trying to get across. And that I teach a sport and society class, and sport provides us a place to have a conversation that many times it's much more difficult to have. And President Obama realized that. And for those who criticize him for being at a baseball game, it's like, you actually don't understand Cuban history. And how much of an insult it would have been for the president to be in Cuba and not to go to a game.
Right, because the timing of that, the criticism was, this was around the time of the attacks in Belgium. I wanted to ask you, as you were talking about particularly a Cuban baseball, Afro-Cuban baseball, but then just how much did Jackie Robinson pave the way for Afro-Caribbean athletes just to enter the American League?
Before Jackie Robinson, all of the Latino players who played in the major leagues were either white or not black, as presented by major league team owners to the public.
Did they try to get them to pass? Is that what
well,
they were just...
They manipulated racial categories. And this is the owners who were doing it, so they can get the talented labor out of baseball players out of the Caribbean into the league. What Jackie allowed was for all Latinos, regardless of shade and regardless of background, to be able to play. He opened the path for Minnie Minoso to become the pioneering player that he was, as the first ambiguously black Latino to play and to star in the major leagues. And that was why Jackie was so important, because before Jackie Robinson in the major leagues, the color line was built around the ambiguity of Latinos. Jackie was needed to shatter all ambiguities and to reconstruct the American game into one of a real meritocracy.
Well, and there was also, I wanted to ask you one baseball question, actually two baseball questions about how he also changed the game, which is, I wanted to ask you how much he contributed to the modern way the game is played, with the play that he brought in from the Negro Leagues, with stealing bases and leading off. How much of that changed what we know about modern baseball today?
The Negro League style of play that Jackie learned in the Negro Leagues was transformative of the aesthetic, of the style, and even fandom, in because it was so much more about direct challenge of what baseball had become, a very plotting game as it was segregated, Major League Baseball, I should say. And Jackie helped to transform that. The other part of that story is Jackie also learned that when he played in the Caribbean, that he had played in Venezuela prior to playing with the Dodgers and then playing against Cubans during exhibition games. So the Negro League game was really rooted in an interaction between African Americans and Latinos in the Negro Leagues and in Latin America. And Jackie exemplified that and made it, well, maybe if not okay, made it part of the game.
Well, made it really fun, a lot more fun to watch in some ways too, right? There's a, as I said before, I'm not a huge baseball fan, so I don't know that much about baseball history, but I didn't know the story of Pee Wee Reese throwing his arm around Jackie Robinson in Cincinnati. There's like a statue of this. Did this really happen?
No.
So this is not a true story.
And this is one of the powerful elements of what having Rachel there to talk about what actually happened. Historian Jules Tigil actually documented that this Pee Wee Reese put his arm around Jackie in Boston in a game against the Boston Braves.
Okay.
But one of the dynamics that emerges for me as a historian is integration stories and how they're recreated to kind of suit a particular narrative and make particular heroes. Pee Wee Reese was courageous, but it wasn't because his family was in attendance in a game in Cincinnati. Somebody else came up with that. And then it gets immortalized in the movie 42. That never happened.
Okay, so everyone knows. If you see 42 versus the Ken Burns version, you could figure out which one is the actual historical fact. You know, we're just wrapping up. We just have a couple more minutes. But as you're saying all of this about baseball and society, I wonder how you think the Cuba opening, if that has the potential to not just change the sport in terms of how many baseball players are sort of in the MLB, but also just sort of a broader political opening. I'm curious what you think.
I think, you know, we're seeing the 21st century version of baseball diplomacy, and the respect that both nations can exhibit to one another via baseball, I think, will have an impact on the political interactions because we both speak the language of baseball. Baseball arrived to Cuba at the same time it arrived to California, the 1860s. And so Cubans are not recent arrivals to this game. And I think this is an opening. And as a historian of the Caribbean, I find it an exciting moment.
What do you want the world to know about Jackie Robinson?
Jackie Robinson was a courageous man who led, who was pioneering a process of integration that would play over again and again. He was the inspiration for thousands, tens of thousands. Because Jackie did it, they felt the courage to try it themselves.
That's Adrian Burgos Jr. He teaches history at the University of Illinois, and he was advisor to the Ken Burns documentary. It's a two-part series that begins. It starts at 8 o'clock tonight on WILL. If you're in the Champaign-Urbana area, you can check your local listings elsewhere to find out exactly what station it's on. But Adrian, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on. Que viva baseball.
Coming up, what's your favorite Ramona Quimby book? Beverly Cleary turns 100 tomorrow. We're going to be speaking with Illinois children's book authors about how she influenced them. You're listening to The 21st. Stay tuned.
Support for the 21st comes from the library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, helping to generate new knowledge and developing and evaluating new technologies and methodologies that better distribute scholarly knowledge. This is your university library.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
Hello, my name is Sheila Kelly Welch. Beverly Cleary's books turned our older son into a reader, and now I love sharing her writing with our grandkids. I became a fan when I was in fourth grade. By the time I was in junior high, I had decided to become a children's writer and illustrator. When my first children's novel was published, it's called Don't Call Me Marta, I sent a letter and the book to Beverly Cleary. In my story, the main character's family is about to meet an 8-year-old they hope to adopt. Marcia is apprehensive because she's been told that this little girl is developmentally delayed, and she often acts like a 3-year-old. Marcia thinks she'd much rather meet Ramona than this stranger who will become her sister. I didn't know what to expect. Maybe a postcard with the autograph of this famous author. Well, Beverly Cleary sent me a charming handwritten thank you note that I've kept all these years since 1990 in our safe deposit box. So I'd like to wish a happy 100th birthday to a kind and exceptional author.
That was Sheila Kelly Welch, a children's book author based in Northern Illinois. This weekend, we asked Illinois authors to share how Beverly Cleary influenced them. That's because, as you heard, tomorrow is Beverly Cleary's 100th birthday. She's the author of many well-known children's books, including Ramona Quimby, age 8, Henry and Beezus, The Mouse and the Motorcycle. Today, we're talking with Cynthia Liu. She's a children's book author who lives in Chicago. Cynthia, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Cynthia, you know, like every child, or like every child who's a fan of Beverly Cleary, I should say, I remember the exact part of my elementary school library. I think I remember the exact shelf in the corner of the library where all the row where all the Beverly Cleary books were, because I would just sit there and read the books. And I wonder, for you, what memories you have of reading her stories as a child?
I actually remember pulling out Ramona's book off the shelf. Which is really bizarre that I remember that. But I think part of what it was that it was Ramona Quimby, age 8, mm-hmm. and I might have been close to 8 or something. And I thought, okay, this book is for me. And I remember reading that story and falling in love immediately with the character of Ramona. And also after that, I just voraciously read all of Beverly Cleary's books that I could get my hands on at that time, and anything that was in the shelf in the library that had her name on it. So Ralphus Mouse is another character that I fell in love mm-hmm. with as well. Mm-hmm. So those are the two that ring very clearly in my mind as a kid who was growing up in the 80s. And I remember even when I hit the books that were from the 50s, I remember thinking the covers were outdated and going, ooh, am I going to like this? And then, of course, I did. So her books do withstand the test of time 30 years later. And even today, recently my daughter read Ralphus Mouse, and again, I still loved it. So it doesn't really change. I think many people who talk about Beverly Cleary talk about how her books are still super enjoyable no matter what age you are.
And that's what I wanted to ask you about, Cynthia, right? Because certainly the covers have changed. We were having fun this morning, the staff of the 21st, because we were looking through covers, and I remembered the Ramona Forever cover that I had as a kid. And of course, now it's really different. But other than the covers of the book, what is it you think that makes Ramona or Henry or even Ralph the Mouse? I mean, what is it about it that makes it so timeless, you think?
It has to be, for me, I actually wanted to look at this more closely last night. I was looking at opening pages, because that's usually how readers judge a book, is those first opening lines. And no doubt, like so quickly, Beverly Cleary is so good at capturing a character that a child can connect with like practically instantly. If you look at Henry Huggins and the opening lines of that, she talks about a boy who has basically lost his adult teeth grown in, has broken an arm before, but has basically had nothing ever happen to him. And I think how many kids can relate to that? Millions of kids can relate to the fact that they've gone through all these basic life experiences but feel like they've had nothing happen to them. So instantly I can see how a kid could get pulled in and want to know why there's a story about Henry Huggins. And Ramona herself, in that opening line, she worries about getting a talking to. And in one line, there you go. There's the connection right there of how many kids worry about getting a talking to.
Yeah, I think it's a lot defense. Of the, right, the verbal, like it's sort of everything Ramona's going through. I remember very much having the same sort of anxieties or worries or how you get in trouble. I think maybe that's what it is, right? I'm speaking with Cynthia Liu. She's a Chicago-based children and teen book author. Author of the picture books like Bike on Bear or Woby and Peep. She also wrote Paris Pan Takes the Dare. It's a mystery novel for older kids. How has Beverly Cleary's works, how did that impact you as a writer, Cynthia?
I would have to say, because I Beverly Cleary is one of my favorite authors, and there were other authors when I was reading books constantly as a kid that I think I just absorbed, and that was E.B. White as well.
Mm-hmm.
And when I think about these
Charlotte's
Web,
right.
Charlotte's Web, Stuart Little, these stories. When I think about those two authors, I think I've actually absorbed not only the way they tell their stories, but how the writing style. Their stories are extremely accessible, easy to read as a kid. So when I think about, I didn't necessarily pattern my work after them necessarily, but I know that I must have somehow globbed onto this notion that when I write books for kids, I do try to make them very easy to read, very accessible. So it's basically, you know, there's nothing that you really have to think that hard about to understand the story. Second, I think that these authors did a great job of getting into the heads of kids. You really have to be able to capture what it's like to be a kid, to write realistic fiction. And Beverly Cleary did a great job of that with Ramona. She really got into the head of that child. Many children, even if they're not as outspoken as Ramona, can probably identify with having a lot of those kinds of thoughts that Ramona did as she went through everyday life experiences. So I think being able to connect with the reader and thinking about what they go through in their daily lives, the kinds of emotions that children go through, and trying to being able to capture that in any story for children is probably something I always think about when I'm crafting my own stories. And I think both E.B. White and Beverly Cleary did an amazing job of capturing that emotion and that experience of what kids go through, and use like everyday type situations or, you know, even in their more imagined stories, the emotions of children, even if it's an animal, you know.
Well, and that's what I was going to ask you about, Cynthia. When we're thinking about children's books today and popular children's books, do you think that it's, I was going to ask about if you think, do you think the audience or the industry has changed when we're talking about, because this is sort of, Ramona Quimby is kind of in that age, the Beverly Cleary age is a younger reader. It's sort of a, it's my first book kind of reading. It's not like the Harry Potter or like a, maybe that's something older kids maybe would kind of gravitate towards. Do you think that the writing has changed?
I don't think necessarily the writing has changed. I think that what we're publishing is what we need to publish. The attitudes about that is changing. So there's always going to be need for a story that kids can connect with, and I don't think that core you know requirement is changing. But I do know that there's an increased demand for books that better reflect our kids that are reading today. And one of the major topics that is going on in industry is diversity.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a really good example of something that you hear about a lot, that we need to write more stories that reflect all kids, not just white middle-class America. So when you think about that is definitely something that is changing, that publishers are paying attention to and listening and trying to change that sort of thing that's been going on. Also, family situations. It's not always a married family. There's definitely
or a mom and a dad, right?
Mm-hmm. Or a mom and a dad. There's single parent families as well. I mean, all different kinds of families are not necessarily reflected in children's literature, and so that's another thing. There's also different kinds of genres. Poetry, for example, is something that is kind of fallen by the wayside, except perhaps in picture books for younger kids. It's very difficult for a major trade publisher to publish like a collection of poetry for children. But today, now that we're able to find information so easily through technology and the internet, you're starting to hear from our readers.
That's what I was going to ask you about, Cynthia, in terms of technology, how much that's changed. Mm-hmm. the publishing industry for children's books? Because when you look at sort of the Amazon influence, the self-publishing influence, do you see that changing the way children's books are being published also?
Yes, I think it's just a matter of time before everything starts to really, it's bubbling now, and I think now there's a new entrance coming into play, smaller press that is strictly print on demand.
And is that for the good? Like, do you think that's better because then you get that diversity in there?
Absolutely. I think that the more voices that you hear from writers and readers, the better literature that you get out there. Basically, you're going to be able to see more stories being created that can connect directly with the reader that they're intended for and for everyone. I think one of the things that's happened in traditional publishing up until this point is that we have a tendency to say, oh, well, if this is a book featuring a diverse character, it's only meant for for people who are of color. Like, these books are only for black people or Chinese people or whatever. And that's really not the case. You know, we as children, when you think about how kids view the world, they don't really box it into categories. But yet we as adults have done that to our books. And so the more we hear from readers and from parents and from teachers and librarians out there in cyberspace, and the more writers understand that they have the power to actually create their own stories and get them to readers, the more pressure it puts on the whole industry to start listening to how diverse our world is and how we need more diverse stories in general. And I don't mean just about race and ethnicity. I mean about all the kinds of stories that we like to see out there.
So, Cynthia, that said, we just have about a minute or two left. I wanted to ask you, for parents who are listening or for aunts and uncles who want to get diverse kids' books for the kids in their life, where do you think the best place for them to go is to find that?
If we're talking about diversity in terms of, like, different sorts of ethnicity, that sort of thing, then I would definitely check out We Need Diverse Books. That's a movement that's going on.
Okay.
And you should.
And
be
is that
part
a website?
Of that movement. Yeah, I would. I don't know what the URL is, but just Google pound We Need Diverse
the
Books.
The hashtag. Okay.
Also, yes. Also, just speak about it. If you're on Facebook or Twitter, connect with librarians and teachers and booksellers. And start talking. I think when you have the conversation, then things start to change. And we are doing that as creatives out there. And there's definitely a difference just by communicating and speaking up. And I think, and also put your money where your mouth is, right? So if you see titles that you support, go buy the book. Go check it out from the library, because we know that publishers make a lot of decisions based on numbers. So if this is something you're passionate about and you see something that reflects what you want to see more of, be sure to register it in the system somehow by checking it out or purchasing it.
And our great producers, our fantastic producers are telling me that the website is diversebooks.org. So if you are interested, you can go to diversebooks.org. I want to thank Cynthia Liu, a Chicago-based author of children and teen books. The picture books include Bike on Bear and Woby and Peep, and also a mystery novel for older kids, Paris Pan Takes the Dare. Cynthia, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
We also received a message from Libertyville-based children's author Suzanne Slade, who wanted to wish Beverly Cleary a happy 100th birthday and share this story from her childhood.
Hi, this is Suzanne Slade. In fourth grade, my teacher asked us to write a letter to our favorite author. So I wrote to Beverly Cleary because I loved her books about Ralph the Mouse, Runaway Ralph, and the Mouse and the Motorcycle. And to my surprise, she sent me a letter back with a handwritten note. She answered my question if she was going to write another book about Ralph and said she would after she finished a book she was writing about Ramona. So I think her letter really helped inspire me. I now write children's books, and I get to show this letter to students when I go do school visits. And it was just so kind of her to send the letter, and she showed me that authors are real people. So I just wanted to share my story today in honor of her 100th birthday. Thanks.
It's tomorrow, but we're going to wish a happy early birthday to Beverly Cleary. Suzanne posted a picture of that letter, by the way, that Beverly Cleary sent. It's on our Facebook page. You can find it by searching for The 21st Show on Twitter. While you're at it, on Facebook. So search for The 21st Show on Facebook. While you're at it, though, you can follow us on Twitter. It's 21stshow. We just tweeted the link to that, as well as to that diversebooks.org. The 21st is produced by Amanda Hunningfort, Christine Herman, and Austin Keating. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft, with help from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our news director. On Friday, we'll be speaking with the women behind the Ebert Fest film Radical Grace. It's a documentary about three Catholic nuns and their boundary-pushing fight for social justice. So tune into The 21st next Friday. Thanks for listening today. I'm Nyla Boodoo.